Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, how to enjoy Thanksgiving dinner through intuitive eating. And small businesses are still facing pandemic-related challenges. But is the holiday shopping forecast necessarily gloomy? To start, we're talking about a landmark trial underway in the state of Pennsylvania. Six school districts and four parents are among a group of plaintiffs suing Governor Wolf, the State Department of Education, and the legislature, saying certain public school districts are badly underfunded, and many children in these districts are receiving a substandard education in violation of the state constitution. The trial has been a long time coming. In recent decades, there have been a number of attempts to bring similar cases to trial, but each time, Pennsylvania's courts punted to lawmakers, saying funding matters are the domain of the legislature. This changed in 2017 when the state Supreme Court decided alleged violations of the state constitution in the latest lawsuit are appropriate for examination in a court of justice. It's a complex story with a lot at stake for children in underserved districts. WHYY's Mallory Falk has been following it for us, and she is here with more. Hello, Mallory.
Good morning.
So petitioners say the state of Pennsylvania has underfunded certain school districts so badly it's violated the state constitution. Tell us more about this.
Sure. So the plaintiffs are saying there's really two pieces of the constitution that the state is violating. The first is its education clause, which says Pennsylvania shall, quote, provide a thorough and efficient system of public education. And so they're arguing that the system the state is providing is not thorough and efficient and is not serving students in the way that the framers intended. They're also pointing to these very wide funding gaps between some of the state's poorest districts and some of the wealthiest districts, and saying that the state is actually violating its own equal protection clause by failing to close those gaps and, in effect, discriminating against students who live in these severely underfunded districts. And so overall, they say students are being denied their right to a quality education guaranteed by the Constitution.
Real estate taxes pay for a sizable chunk of public education in Pennsylvania, but this means there can be a lot more funding than for schools in wealthier areas versus low income. Has the state made efforts to level the playing field, Mallory?
Yes, so the state has made some efforts. Pennsylvania relies more heavily than most other states on local taxes to fund schools. It actually ranks 45th in the percent of school funding that comes from the state. That's something the plaintiffs are repeatedly pointing out. But offense attorneys argue that if you combine state and local funds overall, Pennsylvania spends more money per student than most other states. And it's actually increased the amount it puts toward education funding since the lawsuit was first filed back in 2014. The biggest change is that in 2016, the state passed this funding formula that takes things into account like the poverty level of a school district and how many students in that district are learning English. And so it directs more money toward these lower wealth, higher need districts through that formula. But something the plaintiffs point out is that that formula only gets applied to new funding, so it doesn't apply to the bulk of funding that's going towards state education. And so they say, even though the state kind of did pass this new formula, did create this change, it's still not enough to close these wide gaps.
We heard from the Panther Valley School District Superintendent, the district's among the group of plaintiffs. Where is it located, Mallory?
Yeah, so it's a small rural district, primarily located in Carbon County in northeastern Pennsylvania. It's in a former coal mining community, and the district serves more than 1,600 students. Around 56% of them are classified as economically disadvantaged, though the superintendent on the stand said he actually believes that number is higher. And it's a district that is, taxing its residents. It has the 10th highest tax rate in the state, but because it is this, small, poor community, even with that high tax rate, it just kind of can't make up the money that it needs to fund its district, is what the superintendent had to say when he was on the stand.
Yeah, and David McAndrew also talked about programs that might be on the chopping block.
Yeah, so he was pretty blunt. He said that his district is broke and that last year officials considered cutting out the music, arts, or sports programs entirely. And the only way they were able to plug that gap was through federal pandemic relief funds. But he worries that once those funds run out, those programs could be back on the chopping block. He said, the district because it doesn't have the money it needs, sometimes has to make decisions that aren't in the best interest of students, whether that's considering cutting these, you know, sports and music programs, yeah, or when a teacher retires, not replacing them. And even when they do want to hire teachers, he said it's really hard to recruit and hold on to those teachers because neighboring districts can pay so much more. And so teachers are going to choose a higher paying district, sure, with more resources, with better working conditions than a district like Panther Valley. And that results in, you know, larger class sizes, students not getting the kind of individual attention and support that they need.
Let's talk some more about the defendants in this case, who they are exactly, and what they are arguing primarily, Mallory.
Sure. So there are a few different defendants in the case, as you mentioned earlier. First, we have Republican leaders of the state legislature, and they're arguing that Pennsylvania is meeting its mandate to provide a thorough and efficient education. It doles out money every year and has created a system of free K through 12 education that's open and available to every child in the state. And they argue that, you know, the state constitution doesn't say exactly what the standard of education is that the state has to provide. There's no, there's nothing in there that says this many students need to be on grade level. This is the amount of resources every student is entitled to. And they're also arguing that across the state, including in these plaintiff school districts, schools have what they need to provide a basic education, and in some cases, much more than a basic education. There's a story from opening statements that I think really kind of illustrates the argument that these defendants are making. So in her opening statement, a lawyer for the plaintiffs talked about this athletic director in the William Penn School District who had to travel out of state to get cast off equipment to set up a weight room for student athletes. And it got set up in this abandoned high school shower. Yeah. And one of the defense attorneys pointed to that story during his opening statement. And he said, you know, the Constitution doesn't entitle every student to an adequate weight room, you know, that we shouldn't conflate things that would be nice to have with things that the Constitution requires. And so, you know, they're not arguing that there aren't disparities among districts. Sure. They're not arguing that it isn't somewhat unfair, but that there's a difference between, you know, not having a state-of-the-art weight room and having, you know, your constitutional rights violated and in a legal funding system.
Well, as you report, a lawyer representing GOP House Speaker Brian Cutler referenced the Taj Mahal at one point.
He did. So he was also kind of speaking to this, you know, there is going to be some, you know, some gaps among districts. And he said, I'm not saying every school building is the Taj Mahal, but schools have four walls, a roof, working plumbing, chairs and desks. And he said they have the, quote, basic instrumentalities that are needed to provide the constitutionally mandated education.
Mallory, you mentioned standardized test scores a few moments ago, and plaintiffs do point to this in the trial. What do the scores show?
Yeah, so the plaintiffs are, you know, if the defense lawyers are arguing there is no, like, standard of education that the state is constitutionally required to provide, but the lawyers for the plaintiffs are saying there actually are standards because the state has these statewide standardized tests, and those create these benchmarks for what students should know and how they should be able to perform at a certain grade level. And so they point out that, you know, according to these standardized tests, 44% of the state's third graders fail to meet proficiency standards in math. 38% fall short in English. They say high schoolers only fare slightly better. And students in lower wealth districts are way less likely to be proficient on state exams. And so they're arguing that, you know, if 44% of third graders can't meet the baseline that the state has set, yeah, then that means that schools and students are not provided with what they need to achieve at the level that the state itself has set out.
And how do children of color fare when it comes to funding disparities in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, so one of the things the plaintiffs are arguing is that the inadequate education funding in the state, they say, disproportionately affects Black and Brown students. So they note that the poorest 20% of districts serve half of the state's Black students and 40% of its Latinx students. And so while they say that, you know, the state is violating its equal protection clause by discriminating against all students in these, you know, lower funded districts, in these poor districts, it does have a disproportionate impact on Black and Brown students throughout the state as well.
What is the race to the bottom argument from the defense?
Yeah, so the defense is saying that, you know, there's a concern that if the plaintiffs win, this isn't going to be about elevating the poorest districts. It will be about lowering the wealthiest districts. This concern that there are always going to be inequities. And so does that mean that you set some kind of cap on the wealthiest districts and the money their amount they're able to raise or the resources they're able to provide students? Are you going to limit what they can do to try to even out the playing field? And so that's something that the defense attorneys argue that, you know, they mentioned that when this education clause was written, the delegates considered using the word uniform, saying like a uniform education system, and decided to strike it. And their interpretation is that that means that they wanted, you know, local districts to have control over how much money they raise and how much they offer their students. Though I will say that the plaintiffs brought a constitutional law professor onto the stand who said that was not his interpretation of the word uniform. He thought they just rejected it because they were afraid, you know, people would interpret it too rigidly and think something like every single school needs to use the same textbook or no schools could ever provide a single sex education unless all of them were. So there's some debate about, you know, what the word uniform means and ultimately debate about what does a thorough and efficient education mean. Okay. That's kind of the heart of the case.
Well, ironically, perhaps Governor Wolf is among the defendants. He is a proponent of education funding, though his administration initially opposed the lawsuit. The Wolf and his administration are no longer opposing the lawsuit. What are they saying now?
Yeah, so it seems like they sort of see their role as trying to provide the judge with information about how the education system in Pennsylvania works, how school funding works, so that she can ultimately make a decision in the case. So a lawyer for the Wolf administration during opening statement, you know, he wasn't trying to challenge anything the plaintiffs are saying, you know, has been acknowledging that there are funding gaps and that those can affect educational outcomes, but they're really seeing their role as providing the judge with the information she needs to better understand how the state measures students, how the state funds schools, and then she can kind of draw her own conclusion about whether or not the state's violating its constitution.
Are plaintiffs asking that a specific funding formula be put into place should the court decide in favor of them?
No, so they really say that if they're successful, it's going to be up to the state legislature to decide what the funding system should look like. They're not spelling out a specific dollar amount that the state should be putting into education. They haven't proposed a specific funding formula. They are just trying to prove that the current system is unconstitutional and then leave it to the state legislature to determine what do we do about that? How do we come up with a more adequate and equitable system for funding schools?
And Mallory, how long till we hear a decision? What's the estimate?
So the trial is expected to last anywhere from 8 to 10 weeks. We just finished the first full week of testimony last week. This week, the court is off for Thanksgiving. And lawyers are going to be calling dozens of witnesses, including, you know, school administrators from these 6 plaintiff school districts, funding experts. The defense will call their own witnesses. And so it'll be a while before
we've got to leave it there. Sorry, we've got to leave it there. Mallory Falk, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, no diet talk on Thanksgiving. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. With Thanksgiving just a few days away, many of us look forward to indulging in rich, amazing traditional family foods, even if there's a little voice in the back of the head nagging at us about the extra poundage that might result. Well, our next guests are urging us to consider adopting the practice of intuitive eating as we navigate the holidays and the rest of the year. With intuitive eating, there's no dieting and no skipping meals. The philosophy is more about learning to be in tune with what the body needs and then respond with food. Delina Soto and Isabel Vasquez call themselves the anti-diet dietitians. They are co-founders of Nutritiously Yours, and they join us now for the roundup. Isabel Vasquez, great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
And Delina Soto, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, questions or comments, the number is 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. So we're going to get to Thanksgiving in just a moment. But first, let's get some basics. Intuitive eating versus dieting. So ditch the diets for good. Why, Delena?
So I think that we all know that diets don't work. We have been on them, cycled through them, and it's a constant, you know, reminder of what doesn't work. So why not try something different where you get to enjoy life and food?
Isabel, you both say we are born intuitive eaters. Give us a fuller definition of intuitive eating, of what this is.
Yeah, so it's really about tuning into your own body and being able to notice and honor its cues, right? We're born with this intuitive wisdom that we learn to not trust through diet culture. As babies, we all eat when we're hungry. We stop when we're full. Some days we eat all the mac and cheese and none of the strawberries, and the next day we do the reverse. So we're very intuitive, and we haven't yet picked up all these learned beliefs from society, essentially. So it's really about kind of getting back to that.
So, and then I was going to ask, why do we lose this intuition about our bodies and food?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's really diet culture. Like, we have all these messages constantly from the time we can understand them that gaining weight is bad and certain foods are bad and others are quote unquote good, and all these sorts of beliefs that really shape our beliefs around food and about what our bodies should look like and should do. And so it's really kind of diving into that and breaking those down and working through, you know, noticing where we learned them from. It could have been family, you know, social media, both. Like, there's so many ways, but it's essentially all coming from that diet culture.
And Delena, holidays, as we all know, holiday get-togethers can be joyful and also a minefield when it comes to family, who might tell us exactly what they're thinking, whether we want to hear it or not. You know, sometimes people do talk about weight and about body size, especially if they haven't seen us for a while. Are we talking about preparing before we get there to kind of deal with weight stigma?
So, yes, I think it's important to remember who's going to be around you and remember what the holidays are about, right? The holidays are about spending time with the people that we love and care for and enjoying traditions and just enjoying the time together, which, you know, in the past 2 years we haven't had much of. So I think it's about just going into the holidays and setting some gentle boundaries with whoever it is that you think you need to set them. If it is just, you know, call them ahead of time so that they don't feel like you're putting them on the spot once you get there and they say something. Having those conversations ahead of time, I think it can be very beneficial for everyone involved. You know, saying things like, I'm working on my health and I'm working on my relationship with food. I really would appreciate it if you didn't comment on what I'm eating or my weight or my looks. Even saying things like, I, you know, feel uncomfortable when you say XYZ about my plate or about how I look. I think it's about really helping others understand that you're not willing to engage in those talks, but you're willing to spend time with them.
So as you're preparing dishes, perhaps also prepare people you might run into on Thanksgiving. You know, it sounds like a good idea because then you avoid conflict on a day in which we're trying to, you know, get together with people we care about. But Isabel, I guess even before we get there, we have to, you say we should listen to our bodies in a non-judgmental way. So first, let's start with what we need to, how you think we need to approach that image in the mirror.
Yeah. So, I mean, this, you know, I want to also normalize that this can be a hard process because it involves unlearning a lot of these beliefs. And so, you know, it can start with just working towards some level of acceptance. So we're not necessarily, you know, I wouldn't expect somebody necessarily to start looking in the mirror and love what they see, right? That often feels unrealistic. So first, acceptance, it could be some gratitude. So it could just mean sending some appreciation to something that our body does for us or a certain part of our body. It could be, you know, our hands for helping us to prepare the food or that sort of a thing. Just how does your body allow you to be present with the people that you love on this day? Starting there, I think, is a good place.
So let's talk about the terrific foods that we might expect to encounter on Thursday. You speak of cultural foods like, say, fried plantains and how they might be viewed in mainstream nutrition circles. Is there necessarily a right or wrong way to look at these foods?
I mean, not so much right or wrong. I think that's another, you know, being conscious of the black and white. I think it's really each person has different cultural practices, different personal preferences with food. And so I think it's, you know, about being willing to have the foods that you enjoy and allowing yourself to enjoy them, because that also helps us to connect with that level of satisfaction that we get from those foods, to connect culturally, you know, familially. Like, those foods provide us a lot of connection as well, that I don't ever dismiss. And so if it's a food that's important to somebody, I think they, definitely can enjoy it and have it. And just they can start to then notice how much of it and when they really want it, to find satisfaction with it. And then usually we're able to kind of move on and carry on with our day and live our fullest life without then obsessing over the food beyond that.
So, Delina, if we're looking at the Thanksgiving spread, and I know in my family there's always a really great, rich mac and cheese, and people bring all sorts of desserts, and I want to eat intuitively. From your perspective, how do I approach all this so that I keep my body healthy at the same time?
Yeah, so I think the goal is to not skip meals prior. I think we have this culture of saving up calories and I need to fast before I go there so that I can eat everything, right? So what this causes, it's that all or nothing mentality, which then causes us to feel like, oh my God, I have to eat everything that's there because I'm never going to have it again, or I won't be able to enjoy it again until next year. So it causes a lot of conflict, inner conflict, with us, instead of just coming into the holiday party with, you know, a nourished, fed body already, not having skipped meals, and allowing yourself, right, to look at the spread and say, what's actually going to taste good to me today? Yeah. Maybe the mac and cheese looks amazing, but I just don't feel it right now because I, you know, maybe had it a few weeks ago, and maybe I want to focus more on some of the other dishes there. It's maybe, you know, letting go so much of the all or nothingness, and also reminding yourself that you can take the mac and cheese home, right?
Sure.
That you can have that mac and cheese any time of the year, that you don't have to necessarily indulge that way, as in like eat so much that you're going to feel uncomfortable, and just allow yourself to pick and choose what's going to make you feel good at that moment, what's going to taste good for you at that moment, and knowing that you could always come back for more, either in 30 minutes, in an hour, the next day, in 2 days. It's having that relationship with food that allows you to know that it'll always be there. Yeah. You don't have to have it all at once.
I like the idea of perhaps taking some home if you're not perhaps in the mood for it at the moment, because then if your sister-in-law says, hey, how'd you like my mac and cheese? You know, and you have an out, and a good one, too. So say we do overindulge and don't feel so well afterwards. Isabel, what can we do perhaps to get back on track?
Yeah, so I mean, it's totally normal for that to happen, especially I think on a food-related holiday, and that's not something that, you know, has to be viewed as bad. It just can be like, and then it can, you know, I might invite you to then start to think about maybe why, if maybe beforehand you didn't eat consistent meals or that sort of a thing. Like, was it because you were at the point of that extreme hunger where you just ended up eating to uncomfortable fullness as a result? Is it that you're restricting those certain types of foods that maybe you actually really enjoy, but you don't allow yourself to eat on other, you know, other times of the year? So that's another form of restriction that can then end up leading to eating beyond that point of comfortable fullness. So I would definitely invite some, you know, questioning of maybe why, and also what what's that bringing up for you? Is it just the physical discomfort, which is normal? Is it also emotional discomfort? So is there also like guilt coming up? All those sorts of like negative self-talk, is that coming into the picture? Because that kind of signals a lot of, you know, internalized diet culture beliefs. So that's an opportunity to work through that and ask yourself, why do I feel so guilty? What do I think this says about me? Yeah. And why?
Delina Soto, you know, for people with, you know, medical health concerns, how would you advise they employ intuitive eating, even if their physicians might say, you know, avoid dishes with a lot of salt or fats, that sort of thing?
So, yeah, so I think there's a common misconception that intuitive eating doesn't take chronic conditions or health into play when we're discussing these things. The goal of intuitive eating is to help you find health, right, on your own terms without having these restrictive rules. So one thing is saying, hey, we want you to watch, you know, your sugars because you're diabetic. And another thing is saying you can't have it at all. Right. So I think that it's important to really work with somebody, either your medical professional or a dietitian, that can help you find what foods work for you and your body when you're managing a chronic condition. It doesn't have to be all or nothing, which I think is what a lot of the mainstream diet culture makes us feel like. If I'm diabetic, all sugar is, you know, off limits. If I have high blood pressure, I can't have any salt, which I think is very extreme. We need to learn really what works with our body, because we all react differently to food when it comes to chronic conditions. So it's about finding what works for you.
Do you advocate tweaking recipes, say, you know, switching out animal fats that might be less healthful for some people for, you know, like extra virgin olive oil?
I advocate for eating whatever makes you feel good. There are some traditional dishes that really taste to certain people better if they have, you know, that animal fat, such as like, you know, a butter or a lard. And then other people really, truly enjoy it if we substitute the olive oils. I'm a proponent of really, let's figure out what's going to work for you, your family, your traditional dishes, your lifestyle, and let's incorporate those things. But there's not one right answer for everyone.
Isabel Vasquez, tell us about some dishes you're looking forward to on Thursday and how you plan to navigate.
COVID kind of, you know, I think made things all different for me, but, you know, some dishes that I really love are my grandma's mac and cheese is amazing. Sweet potatoes, tostones. So those are like the fried plantains, pernil, which is like a roasted pork. And I just gonna enjoy, I'm gonna kind of, you know, see what sounds good on that day. Connect to, you know, what's feeling good, what's going to be satisfying for me, and just enjoy the time with my family.
Yeah, and I did neglect to mention, you know, COVID is obviously still among us, and for those who are not gathering or don't feel they can gather this particular Thursday, maybe Delina Soto, an idea would be to plan a meal for down the road when people feel they're in a safer situation.
Yeah, ideally it's doing what works for you, right? And what works for your family. So I think that's really what differentiates intuitive eating from a lot of things. It's that it doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be multiple things.
It's freeing. It sounds freeing. You're not restricted by dietary guidelines or diets, I should say.
Yeah.
There's been some progress made in embracing different body types in the fashion world, which seems to be encouraging. But do we overall as a society still have a ways to go, Isabel?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all about holding space for both. So I think you're absolutely right. And there's a lot of movement in a positive direction and being a lot more inclusive. And there's a lot of ways that weight stigma is extremely present in our society. I mean, it's really prevalent, but like you said, I think there are also positive strides that are happening. And so I'm hopeful that that really continues on.
Yeah. And as we speak of this, though, let's talk about some more of the diet pitfalls that are still out there. Weight cycling. Delina Soto, tell us about this.
So, yeah. So what we would consider weight cycling is basically yo-yoing back and forth with weight. So you go on a diet, you drop a tremendous amount of weight, you stop such diet because it was restrictive, you couldn't continue to do it, something happened in your life that just
you know, had you have to stop this way of eating, which was restrictive, and then your weight goes back. And oftentimes we see that it actually goes back even more. Mm-hmm. So what we do know is that, you know, a lot of the research shows us that diets and, you know, extreme ways of eating are one of the most constant predictors of weight gain. So why are we continuing to do this to ourselves? Why are we continuing to do these super restrictive diets to then actually gain more than what we lost? So I think that, you know, the goal is to really, again, find what works for you and your body and find that stability, because that's where we find a lot of the health, right? We're talking about health behaviors when we're talking about wanting to be healthy, and weight is not a behavior. So what can we work on to be able to help you get to the optimal health that you're trying to achieve?
You say look at the whole body, considering food and other factors.
Yeah, like your movement, your stress. How much are you sleeping? You know, what are you, you know, doing for joy in the day? You know, how are you creating space for you to really work on your health, right? I think we often only think about food and exercise, but there's so many other things that affect.
Yeah. And I neglected
in general.
I'm sorry. I neglected to ask you a little bit earlier. I don't want to make assumptions about how your family's handling this Thanksgiving, but are there any dishes you're looking forward to either this week or in the holidays, during the holidays?
So Isabel and I are both Dominican. So we have a lot of the same dishes. She mentioned a lot of the dishes that I'll be enjoying as well at my family gathering. But yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to just enjoying some time with my family. We're having a little of a bigger get together this year than we did last year. So it's exciting to see some of my family that I haven't in a while. And yeah, like Isabel said, just enjoying whatever feels good that day, whatever tastes good that day, because again, I can have that food whenever I really choose to.
And Isabel Vasquez, as we wrap up, we've got about 30 seconds. Again, as we approach the Thanksgiving table, tips to approach it with intuitive eating. As we wrap up.
Yeah, definitely. Biggest one is eat consistently earlier in the day. Don't set yourself up to feel that extreme hunger and deprivation and then feel out of control and not really be able to enjoy the food. Stay fueled earlier on and just enjoy the time with your family and try to, you know, just enjoy the food without the guilt. Be conscious of the guilt and try to reframe it if it comes up for you.
Yeah. Well, happy Thanksgiving, Isabel Vasquez, Delina Soto, co-founders of Nutritiously Yours, the Anti-Diet Dietitians. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Up next on the Regional Roundup, how small businesses are faring during the holidays. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The official start to the holiday shopping season begins the end of this week with Black Friday and Small Business Saturday. For many small businesses, this one Saturday in the calendar year can help make or break the bottom line, especially this year as the pandemic continues to wreak havoc on inventory. The supply chain is backed up on a number of fronts, meaning sometimes goods get to stores months behind schedule. And so business owners are hoping to move the products they have in store now as crowds begin to gather. And from what we're hearing, the hunt for holiday gifts is well underway. According to the Commerce Department, sales were up over 1.5% in October, despite rising inflation. We'll speak with small business owner Francis Pascal in just a bit. But first, let's get the big picture on small businesses and the holiday season from Rachel Riley. Rachel Riley is Senior Director of Communications for the Valley Forge Tourism and Convention Board. Hi, Rachel. Nice to have you with us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Hard to believe the holidays are upon us already. So let's talk about what small businesses are doing to prepare and also get into some of the challenges this year brings. So challenges first, the supply chain issue is a big one. Tell us more about this.
Absolutely. So it's not just supply, but staffing too. I mean, when you go into any restaurant, any store, no matter the size, but especially for small local businesses, I'm sure you're hearing, we aren't offering this menu item, or we can't, or we don't have. But I think they're doing a great job of offering alternatives. And we're seeing that across the board. And of course, it's not just food distribution either. Technology, we're having some issues there, seeing some shortages. And it's all over the world, really, not just even this area and this region. But the staffing is also an issue too. So not just what they're offering folks, you know, their product, but having the staff to be there to sell it to help customers. That has been a struggle too, due to the pandemic.
That's been around for a while. Is the staffing situation starting to ease at all?
It's definitely getting better. I mean, for the tourism and hospitality industry, at the height of the pandemic last year, we normally have a positive economic impact of $1.65 billion. So we're still seeing momentum, and the jobs are anywhere from 25 to 30,000 jobs in Montgomery County alone. Mm. And that was down about 85% at the height of the pandemic. So we're definitely seeing places in our industry hire, posting positions, they're looking for people. And at one point, they were struggling to bring people in for interviews or actually hire people. But now we're starting to see they are bringing more staff on. It's just not necessarily keeping up with the demand of people who've been cooped up for almost 2 years now, who want to get back out to eat, to enjoy attractions and entertainment, to stay overnight. You know, we're still needing some patience there between meeting that demand and having the staffing that we're having.
Yeah. There is some reason for optimism this year. Reading in the Wall Street Journal that households across the country have accrued about $2 trillion in excess savings since the start of the pandemic. And so even though we're seeing an increase in inflation, people seem to be ready to shop. So this is, it looks like good news for the small business community. Am I right?
Absolutely. I think it's great news for our county, for our small local businesses, because that means that, again, there's that thirst, there's that demand for people who haven't been getting out, who now want to. They want to celebrate. They want to reunite with loved ones, family, friends, neighbors, you name it. And they have the money to do so. So this year, especially when you compare to last year at this time, we were told stay in your houses. You can't get together. It's not safe. It's not healthy. This year, there's definitely more positive movement and more optimism, more encouragement. So I think people have that hope that we're moving past it, and they do feel safe and healthy enough to get together for the most part. So they're going to get out there and do that. And they have the money to spend, which is great.
One more question. Back to supply for just a moment. If a business is out of an item that a consumer wants, what are some of the options the businesses are offering? You spoke of alternatives a few moments ago.
Sure. We've seen anything from restaurants offering alternate menu items to shops offering different gift items. So I think that they are understanding where customers are coming from when they're coming in looking for something. And I think these folks have really gone above and beyond to try to do their best to meet that demand with the staffing that they have and offer alternatives to make sure that they're keeping those customers satisfied and happy with what we have. We're working with what we have right now.
Okay, I'd like to bring Frances Pascal into the conversation right now. Frances is CEO of Holland & Milan Organics, a plant-based skincare, cosmetics, natural products business operating out of Ardmore. Welcome to the Regional Roundup, Frances.
Good morning, Mary. Good morning, listeners.
Good morning to you. So you became a small business person after your sister passed away a few years ago. Tell us about that.
Yes, so she suffered from lupus, which attacked her skin, major outbreaks and lesions. I grew up holistic. I'm vegan. So I grew up on herbs, and I just, you know, became a little creative for her and mixed and matched herbs, which ultimately healed her skin. But the lupus had attacked her heart, which was the cause of her demise. But I, you know, felt that there was a great need for my products. You know, I wanted to continue to help to heal. However, unfortunately, when the pandemic hit, I was not able to reach the people the way that I had hoped. But I became really creative and, you know, just started with the marketing, social media aspect, Facebook, of course, Instagram, and that helped a great deal.
Earlier in the conversation, Frances, we spoke of supply chain issues. Are you experiencing this?
Yes, we did. There were times where we would wait 30 days, a month and a half. But, you know, I became creative and I started to buy in bulk, you know, our jars, our bottles, you know, just to be ahead of the curve.
Yeah. And how's it going now?
It's great. Yeah. It is amazing. You know, the pandemic opened up a lot of doors for us. We're now on Walmart, Amazon, Etsy, you know, our community, you know, they're major supporters of us. It's going really well. So I can say we have been totally blessed, but we had to be creative in the beginning to get us to this point now.
You operate primarily online. What is the allure of operating a small business online as opposed to brick and mortar?
Well, with the brick and mortar, it's more of a responsibility. That's, you know, face value, contact. And, you know, a lot of people are still nervous to shop. As far as online, you know, you're promoting yourselves, your, you know, discounts, and that's reeling the customers in, and they're receiving their products. If you do like next day shipping, they're getting their products right away, and it's safer at this point.
I don't know if you're operating solo, Frances, or whether you have a staff, but if you do have people working for you, have you experienced staffing issues?
No, I have not. Everyone, you know, they're health nuts, just as I am. You know, everyone is very cautious. They have little ones at home, so everyone's sure to wear their mask, to make sure they sanitize, you know, those procedures.
Are you optimistic about this holiday season?
I am excited and hopeful.
Yeah.
We have great sales. It's all about sales, you know, committing to your customers and giving them, you know, what you think they need. And nowadays with the economy the way that it is, you want to make sure you offer great sales to help your customers. They want your product, but you want to make sure you could give them the product at a discounted rate.
Yeah. You spoke of creativity a couple of times. Are there any obstacles or challenges you foresee ahead that will require some of that creativity to get up over and around them? Frances.
Good question. Whatever comes our way, you know, we just make it work. I'm all about, you know, promoting holistic health, and I know that there's a scare with the pandemic, so I'm offering a discount on our turmeric teas, you know, just supplying the demand, you know, as far as our herbal toothpaste, you know, natural deodorants, just keeping the body healthy every way that we can.
Yeah. Well, Frances Pascal, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
And
good luck.
Thanks, Mary, for having me. It was a pleasure. Happy holidays.
You too. Frances Pascal is a CEO of Holland & Milan Organics. So Rachel Riley, back to you. We spoke again about creativity with Frances. Is it essential if a person owns a small business to have that as one of their tools to really get around the obstacles thrown at them by the pandemic and, you know, the ongoing obstacles? It seems like there's something that perhaps develops every few months or so.
Sure. I think creativity and flexibility, right, are key there. And Frances seemed to talk a little bit about that. These businesses, you know, the word of 2021 or even 2020, I think, was pivot, right? So they've adjusted their business models. Maybe they weren't set up for online ordering, pickup, takeout, delivery, all of those types of things. A lot of them adjusted if they could. Some weren't able to. Some were, to make that happen, to still meet their customers where they were and give them what they needed and still to be able to connect and engage and interact with their customers. And I think that's part of what's key to that creativity and flexibility for them moving forward to keep going.
What is the relationship between the local community and a small business? I mean, if a small business were to close, how does that affect Main Street?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Main Street is all about, it's not your geographic location of being physically on a Main Street. It's about those small local businesses, those faces. They're your neighbors, they're your friends, they're your family. They are the faces of your town and your neighborhood. So they really paint a picture for the landscape of what your town or your neighborhood looks like to have a small business. So if they're not there, that changes that landscape. It changes the dynamic of your town and your neighborhood. So that's why we really need to step up, step in, make sure that we are championing these businesses, serving as brand ambassadors for them, and just supporting them, and not just on Small Business Saturday.
Yeah. Is there still a risk nearly 2 years into this pandemic of some businesses which have made it this far going under?
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, especially within the tourism and hospitality industry, which is one of the hardest hit industries by the pandemic across the world. Within that, two of the segments that were hardest hit were restaurants and then the arts. And I would argue the arts definitely more even so, because you can't necessarily offer takeout arts programs or entertainment. So some of those folks were only just reopening this summer and into the fall. And that's why we really need to patron them now more than ever and support them right now more than ever again to make sure that we keep them around, because these are places that serve our communities in ways that other businesses don't necessarily.
And it's said that small businesses are the backbone of the economy. Small Business Saturday, Rachel, has been around, I guess, about a decade now. What sort of benefit to local businesses have you observed in this one day of the year?
I think it's one day that people take time and take a moment to think about folks and businesses and where their money goes, where their purchases go, more so than any other day in the year. And that's why I said I think it needs to be more than just one day. And out of 365, I think we can give them more than just one day. So I'd love to see folks think about it at least once a month, if not once a week, you know, support those small local businesses. But we do see it definitely boosts marketing for those folks. It's more free promotion for those folks who might not have those marketing dollars or that budget to support themselves. And it gets their name out there, and it just reminds folks to change their perspective and point of view, think differently of who, where, and how they can support.
Yeah, and there remains that competition, that one-click competition from the big guys online.
Absolutely. And I think the great thing, too, about small local businesses is that, especially in Montgomery County, PA, is the diversity, too. Not just the types of businesses, but making sure that we're focusing on supporting Black-owned businesses, LGBTQ-owned businesses, female-owned businesses, Hispanic Latinx-owned businesses. You know, making sure that we're checking out the different types of businesses, as well as learning the stories of the different types of business owners.
What is the significance of the holidays to a small business's budget over the course of a year?
I mean, you know, there's a reason they call it Black Friday, right? Yeah. for lots of different types of organizations and businesses, because you can kind of make or break your year, especially in a year where earlier this year, not so long ago, we had capacity restrictions, we had guidelines, limitations, so they weren't able to serve at full capacity. And even since then, if they're having supply shortages or staffing challenges, you know, they still might not be able to be operating at that 100%. So for a lot of small local businesses, and even big businesses, I would argue, Black Friday can certainly make or break your budget for the year. So that, you know, the holidays are a big deal. And I especially think this year, as you were saying earlier, people have the money to spend. They're hopefully going to do more this year, more experiences, more gifts, you know, share that love with their family and friends and show it to them this year like they weren't able to last year.
Yeah. With all that's been said, Rachel, I mean, if somebody's thinking of starting a small business, is this a good time to do so?
Honestly, yes. We've had businesses in Monco start in the pandemic. We've had restaurants, different types of shops, different types of online companies. So, you know, I mean, I don't know that there's ever a good or bad time to start a business, just like buying a house, right? Like it's very dynamic, always changing. But if someone has that ambition and they think they have a product or something to offer, especially in this area, in this region that no one else is, I say go for it, and we'll be happy to help support you.
Yeah, and just in about 20 seconds or so, what does it take to start? Where do you go first?
Well, I would definitely connect with our Montgomery County Commerce Department, because they have tons of information, resources, and tools, and then they'll connect small businesses with us, because if there's anything we can do to support and help promote them or market them, we're going to do so.
Yeah. Well, Rachel Riley, thanks so much. Great to have you with us. Enjoy the holidays, and best of luck.
Oh, thanks again for having me. Happy holidays, everybody.
Okay. Rachel Riley is Senior Director of Communications with the Valley Forge Tourism and Convention Board. And this correction, earlier we spoke with dietitians Delina Soto and Isabel Vasquez and introduced them as co-founders of Nutritiously Yours. Delina is an anti-diet dietitian and the sole founder of the practice Isabel operates at her business. Sorry about that. So to our listeners, we hope that the holidays treat you well. And to help us all get in the mood, we'll go out on the theme for a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving.